WGS before we begin the festivities. I would appreciate a transmission check. From what I see, I think I'm getting out, but I would like someone to tell me that just to make absolutely sure.
AC2GS, WS2N. Sounds far, Roy. But, you know, longer transmissions will tell a better tale. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I don't listen to my signal. I watch my signal. So I'm looking at the sound envelope, and there's a little descending from the secondary receiver, but I try and figure out if it's noise or just descending. So hopefully this will be better than 2 weeks ago, and certainly much better than last week when we had to cancel it. To everyone out there, if you don't know it yet, I am Alpha Charlie 2 Gulf Sierra, AC2GS, and my name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Limewire Technical Net. It's been going on since 1982, and it continues to go on every Sunday at 8 p.m., and we appreciate people coming to listen, and especially people to participate. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual links and email addresses. Okay, as always, if you cannot address your questions directly on the radio, we have an email address. So if you want to ask a question, if you want to bring up a topic, if you want to offer me a puzzle, it's been a long time since I was able to give people an interesting puzzle to ponder. If you would like me to poke Paul WS2N on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some space-related news and comment on it, the email address to get in touch with me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. There's a whole series of links available. If we have time for science talk, I have a bunch of stories that I could tell you, but if I don't get a chance, you could read the articles that the stories are based on. There's some interesting YouTube. There's a Professor Lewin YouTube about his perpetual motion machine that ain't. And a very good discussion of COVID-19 and why some countries have a high infectious rate and death rate and others don't. So please, take a look at my link page after the technical net. You just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll take you to the link page. If you're interested, we have an active chat room. You can either find it by going to Limewire's website and finding the link, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to the chat room. And as I've mentioned before, I have a stream of the audio of W2VL 24/7, or as much of it as I could make, available. You just point your browser to technet.ac2gs.com, and you can listen in with a simple browser, no radio required. Also, want to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a wonderful archive of the technical net that goes back to September of 2006, and his site is amateurradio.tv, so please avail yourself of it. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you my plans for tonight. Okay, as always, I will ask if anyone has any questions or topics for discussion, and we'll put down their first name and their call sign, and to take them in an orderly fashion. At some point, somewhere between 8:30 and 8:45, we will segue for another edition of Andy, WA2CDL's wonderful Andy's Corner. He will present the topic, and so when that is done, I will return and finish up any questions that might have yet been asked and answered, and ask for any other bits and pieces. We can generalize it to a discussion of science in general and have a chat on the basis of that until about 10:15 or thereabouts, when we will summon Paul WS2N for the SpaceNet report. He will be presenting the report until about 11 o'clock, give or take. And then we will tie a bow on it and wish you all a happy and healthy week. So that's my plans, and we'll see how they work out. If anyone wants to check in and has a question or a topic tonight for the technical net, please hit the push to talk button, give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2VGW with a question.
Okay, KD2VDW recognized. Anyone else want to put their name up there for tonight? Okay, Michael, I guess you're number one, and hopefully some other people will come later on. What's your question for tonight, Michael?
If I was to set up like a QRP rig, 20 watts, and I was going to use a long wire, 9-to-1 un-un, how would I ground that?
Okay, theoretically, if you're operating QRP, the meaning of QRP is 5 watts or less. So you're running a little bit more power than what most people would recognize as QRP. And the big question is, are you doing this portable or mobile, or are you doing this, through your house?
Yeah, so in learning the radio, I would be setting it up in my house. So I'm assuming, the easiest would be, the advice I have, 9-to-1 un-un with a wire. But I'm assuming I would either have to ground the radio or ground the antenna or ground both.
Okay, you don't want to ground the antenna because you want to get the RF up into the air, and you want to get the RF from the air into your antenna. So if you directly grounded it, it would kind of dissipate a lot of the signal into the ground. So what you would want to do is ground something else. As the way you're describing it, it's an NFED, so it doesn't really have something it calls a counterpoise or a radial. It does, though, usually have a balun, the 1-to-9 balun that you mentioned. Those baluns usually have two connections. One is for the end of the NFED piece of wire, and the other is usually denoted as ground. So that's what you got to think in terms of grounding. There are a lot of different ways of grounding it. Am I answering the question that you're presenting before I go further? I just want to make sure we're on the same frequency.
Yes. Like I said, I have a bunch of questions when it comes. So the advice given to me was a 9-to-1 un-un with a wire. But considering that my radio would be on the second floor, that means I would have to take the coax down to the un-un, right? Because the un-un would have to be at the lowest point of the antenna, correct?
Not necessarily. Matter of fact, you probably would, if you had to orient it in any position, although it's not mechanically easy, if you had the feed point higher up, that's the point of the maximum current, so that's where a lot of the signal is going to. At the other end, has a high voltage potential, but a much lower current. So the higher the feed point, the better the antenna will probably work for you. The problem is that most people don't have anything that works like that. So what they end up doing is they position the feed point near their house on a lower level, and they have the other wire connected with some rope or something to a tree or something much higher. It's workable, but theoretically, if you did it the other way, then you probably would get better function out of the antenna. But a lot of people do it the way that you mentioned, simply because that's the easiest mechanical way of dealing with things.
Would one be able to, say, let's say a 30-foot wire, would you be able to lay it on top of your roof for height, or does it need to be elevated a different way?
Assuming that you have an average roof and it's not metallic, you can put it on the roof. People put it on the roof all the time. You have some problem in that, you know, it's important to understand what's right below the roof. If there's a lot of electrical wires and such, it may not be the best, but people do it on their roof all the time. Other people don't have that much length to their roof, so that's why they usually post the feed point against the building and then run the other end as high to a far distant tree as they can. So both things will work, but getting back to the grounding, you want to ground the other end of the ballon, that the part on the side where you're connecting the end fed wire has another connection that usually says ground. So you're going to want to connect it to either a very good counterpoise at the very least, or an actual ground. It depends upon your environment, what you have to ground things to. I use my cold water pipe as a ground. It works almost as good as a copper rod that you can bang into the soil, assuming you have access to soil and such in your backyard.
So this would be different. Would the radio also be grounded, since it does have a ground plug?
Well, it depends upon how things are wired around. So with the ballon, it's a different ground. I mean, you can still ground your radio. Some people don't do it. They float their radios. Others ground them. You'll get some benefit, a degree of lightning protection, more likely some help with the static discharge and such. But it also depends upon your environment. Some people will hook up their internal devices to a ground loop and connect that to a cold water pipe. Some will connect it to a radiator, which is a little bit more possible to be a problem. What I suggest people never do is to hook it up to the electrical ground of their actual outlet, because the ground conditions of a given outlet are not all equal. You have to realize that it's not a straight wire going directly to a ground. It's part of a building-wide electrical system. So there could be all kinds of RF and even low levels of current simmering on a electrical conduit outlet's ground.
Okay, perfect. Yep, I got some homework to do and some things to check out. Thank you so much, Roy.
You're welcome, Michael. And if there's anyone out there who has differing opinions, I would love to hear what they have to say on the subject. Okay, so either everyone agrees with me, or everyone is tired, or everyone doesn't want to particularly talk on the radio right now. Once again, I am ACCGS. My name is Roy, and I am net control for this, the Limark Technical Net. So if anyone else has any questions tonight, please feel free, hit the button, and give us your call sign and your name.
This is WP2VAV. I'm not sure I'm making
it. Yeah, you're about 20% noise, but I can understand you.
This is KD2UDU, Wayne. I also have a question. I'm checking in late, Roy.
Okay, Wayne recognized. Ed recognized. What do you have to say, Ed?
Regarding the previous conversation, what band is that antenna supposed to be on? And I don't understand if it's like a typical HF band, like 40 or 20 meters, what exactly all of this effort by you over the full dipole floating there?
Okay, that's a good question, Ed. I'll punt it to Michael. You know, some people just like one particular type of antenna. He might have some kind of a reason that he can only get away with two position points. Some people like MSET antennas. I agree with you as on a theoretical basis and on a practical basis, most of my antennas are basically dipoles. Michael, any particular reason why you have chosen an NFET?
Yeah, I'm not set on an NFET specifically, but I would have to think, if I'm correct, a dipole has to be suspended in two places. I don't have any trees front or back. The closest thing I could do was from my roof to maybe this woman's clothesline in my neighbor, but I don't have any two points to hang it from.
Well, and it needs one less point of support.
All right, valid point.
Say again, Ed.
Perfectly valid point. If you feel that that makes a difference, then go for it.
Okay, yeah, I agree. There's one major benefit with something like an NFET that you only need to deal with two connections, whereas with a center-fed dipole, you need three points of attachment. So some people just can't situate the three points. And so, you know, an NFET is reasonable. You have to understand that you have to offer it some kind of either ground or counterpoise. Otherwise, it's going to use your coax cable as a counterpoise, and you don't really want your counterpoise radiating. So you really need to make sure that you've properly grounded or counterpoised the NFET in order to limit the amount of RF that gets into your shack and causes your computers to hiccup and all kinds of fun stuff to blink.
Yeah, I guess that's why I also asked. I guess, I don't know, would an inverted V be similar to a dipole? So in other words, if the window came out and the peak was the highest point and I draped the wires over each end of the roof, would that be considered a dipole?
Well, an inverted V is actually a dipole. Dipoles can be positioned in more than one way, although, you know, if you look them up in a textbook, they'll draw them as straight, going off in opposite directions. But many people, myself included, get away as long as you keep the legs at least 90 degrees, from each other. It's not too problematic. If you get less than that, you'll get coupling, and it really diminishes the whole situation. But an inverted V dipole is a legitimate dipole, and as I mentioned before, since a lot of the radiating current is at or near the feed point, the height of that tip of the inverted V makes the difference between a better or worse dipole, all things being equal.
Yeah, I'm thinking I could also, you know, take one point of the dipole from the chimney, go to the back of the house, and then just mount like a pole up there, see the other point, and then run it off the center. That's why I said, just, you know, I've got to look at the roof. It's kind of hard to get up there in this wind and weather.
Yeah, this is not perfect weather, obviously, for antenna installations. A lot of people really love NFETs. I've never really had any NFETs. They do a reasonable job at multiple modes. You still need an antenna tuner to kind of get around some of the mismatches, and you have to be careful about grounding it, or otherwise you get the RFI in the shack. You know, as Ed mentioned, dipoles are very nice. They come balanced, so you don't have to worry too much. It's always good to do one-to-one balance RF chokes then at the feed point just to be on the safe side. And I don't want to keep on promoting my thing, but I have a fan dipole. It's kind of magical to me how just by running parallel wires at different lengths, they auto-select for the band that you use, so you don't need to have any mechanical antenna switch or anything. So fan dipoles have always fascinated me, and I've used them repeatedly. But they're not the only antenna out there. I wish you luck, Michael, and please come back and tell us what you've found out. And if you have any questions, certainly you know where to find us.
Thank you, Roy. Yeah, I'll check out the options. You know, unfortunately, with this weather, it's making me wait. But, you know, a little homework never hurt anybody.
Yeah, it depends upon the way that you look at things. Some people just like to put something up, test it, take it down, put something up, test it, take it down. You know, they have a short attention span, I guess. Other people, I mean, I unfortunately went the other extreme. I spent a good 3 years planning my antenna system before I could arrange for it to be put on my roof. So it gave me a great deal of time to plan it all out. I had drawings. I had drafts. It was semi-ridiculous. You know, sometimes a little bit extra time is good. You figure things out on the planning stage and don't have to deal with the mess of putting things up and then coming to conclusions that there's something wrong with it. I mean, I knew one guy who had a small roof and was planning to put up an antenna that was 105 feet long. And I asked him how he was going to do this. I think he had a 40-foot roof. And he just kind of shrugged his shoulders at me.
Sorry, honey, I spoke to Roy. He said we have to contact the town and put up a tower. No other choice, sorry.
You certainly can try it, and if it doesn't work, blame it completely on me. I'll take it. In the good old days when I used to discuss things like this with Dick, may rest in peace, K2RIW, and Dick always, I think, knew I had a 25 by 20 foot backyard. He kept on trying to convince me that a tower would be the perfect thing for my neighbors and me, and I kept on explaining to him that people in Brooklyn are easily frightened.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I said that my neighbor diagonal, he has two wires going across his yard with, you know, like wraps, basically. It looks like a big bow tie. And he used to set off all the phones and all the TVs. So, yeah, I'm a little nervous to make my neighbors even more nervous.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I learned is how to a degree, camouflage things. And I learned a very important lesson. Before I had my installation kind of lifted and bolted down to my roof, I ran all the rigging and such in my backyard as a preliminary and frightened a few neighbors. They looked at it and they were very scared. And yet, when I lifted it onto the roof, no one apparently looks up anymore. No one said anything anymore. So elevation can hide a lot of things, surprisingly.
Thank you so much, Roy. Yeah, I'll keep you posted.
Okay, very good, Michael. And thank you, Ed. Wayne, KD2UDU, you have a question for tonight.
Yeah, Roy, I do. I want to go back to Mike's problem. Mike, you don't have access to your attic?
My attic is a bedroom. They don't really have, like, one of those walk-in attic spaces.
Oh, all right. Well, all right, Roy. My question is a little kind of hard to explain. I bought a radio through the club from an estate sale, and the radio actually got damaged while it was being demoed. Apparently, it was hooked up to the wrong power supply, and it sent voltage through a board that was not supposed to get that voltage, and it burned up a inductor, and it looks like it damaged two of the transistors that were directly connected to that inductor. So I've replaced the transistors. While I'm having a hard time with the inductor, I ordered a service manual for this radio. It's a Kenwood TS511S. So it's an old HF rig with 10 tubes. It's an old rig, and the service manual calls the inductor. It gives me a part number, Kenwood part number that I'm drawing blanks with. Nobody seems to know what it is, and for some reason, it doesn't give the value of the inductor where, you know, I could track something similar and substitute it. Do you have any idea? They call it a heater choke in the schematic. Would you know if it's a critical part or if I could substitute it with something else? Over.
Well, we just happen to have someone sitting in a corner waiting to talk who's very used to working on all manner of these types of radio. So let's call our specialist in from the corner if we can. Andy, are you out there?
Yes, I am. All right, WHSCDL. Are you officially summoning me from my corner to start?
No. That'll be very soon. It's just Wayne had a question about a TS-511S that got fried a little bit, and he's having problems with something that is designated as a heater choke, but he can't find a value for it. He wants to know if there's any way of replacing it, without finding out more information from the manufacturer.
Okay, all right. Wayne, this is Andy. How you doing? I work on this equipment all the time. But the simplest answer, without taking up too much time right now, Wayne, is to do me a favor, look me up on QRZ. My email address is on QRZ, Wayne. Okay, that's look me up on QRZ. And look at my email address, send me an email with your phone number, and I will call you, and I will have a conversation on the phone and tell you exactly what's going on. I know your situation. I have the schematics for your radios, both of them, the Drake and the Kenwood. I already made some comparisons, and I can tell you what I found. Okay, Wayne, you got that? And let me know. And get back to me. How's that?
Hey, Andy, no problem. I actually emailed you previous. I think I sent you a picture of the radio. But, I'll email you with my phone number. And, you were the other option. I meant to talk to you earlier today when you were on, when George surfaced. And I didn't get a chance to tell you. It's kind of an involved problem. So you're right, it's probably better to talk about it on the phone.
Yeah, then I can give you more information there, that's right. Okay, I know we spoke earlier, very good. Okay, that's good. All right, well, Roy, back to you. And I'm going to give Mike some information also on what he's trying to accomplish.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Andy. Wayne, good luck with that. And if you like it, come back at a later time and tell us how things worked out and tell us about that choke, okay?
Hey Roy, thank you very much. I will definitely, I'm usually on anyway, I'm listening most of the time. I think this is the first time I actually asked a question, but I'm on religiously, I listen. So thank you very much. This is KD2UDU, I'll be standing by.
Okay, very good. So Andy, you wanted to comment about Michael's question about the NFED and grounding it properly and such?
Okay, very good. WHCBL, outside of Andy's corner. Well, here's the thing. Michael, stay tuned because next week I'm actually giving a dissertation. You know, my talk is on different topics, and the topic that I've been talking about is pertaining to antennas and propagation. And I'm going to reread, which is what I read last week, but the problem with the static that we were getting, I'm not sure if my information came across. So what I'm trying to say is, next week I'm going to be talking about the different types of antennas and the antenna fundamentals. So I will talk about that. But right now, you know, Google is always your friend, and of course the lawyer said that many times. I was sort of like paying half attention because I'm doing some reading here at the same time. So what you want to do, just to reiterate, Mike, and I think it's Mike, by the way, I know I wrote it all down, is you want to put up a simple wire antenna, is that correct? You don't want to have three separate locations like a dipole antenna has to be fed somewhere. So let me just get this straight. You want to make an end fed long wire, and that's what they usually call it, end fed. You want to feed it to the end, and you just want to make a long wire antenna. Is that correct? So I know what we're talking about.
Andy, to put it as plain as possible, I've been unemployed for a year. I have a radio. I want to get an antenna up that's sort of not too complicated and not too expensive.
Okay. Well, you came to the right place because the wire antenna is as simple as I'm just saying it, wire antenna. And you can make a N-fed wire antenna or you can make it into a dipole. And incidentally, a dipole does have gain. The gain is approximately 2.1 dB, according to the studies that have been made with dipoles in free space. It's got like a figure eight pattern, broadside to the antenna, broadside to the dipole. In other words, the radiation pattern is sort of like parallel to the dipole and not at the end of the dipole. And by the way, I'll say hello to Ed. It'll be B2EAV since he's listening. You could put up a long wire antenna, but because of the impedance difference, you have to match it. And that's why you were talking about your balance. But a simple half-wave dipole is just as easy to put up, in my opinion, unless you're having or will have problems figuring out where you want to put the feed point on the antenna. I don't know how much property size you have. So, just for clarification, because then I can explain just a few basic things about the NFED as compared to the dipole, and just to let you know. My discussion tonight, by the way, is going to be on UHF and VHF propagation, because that's what I was talking about 2 weeks ago when I was trying to cut through the static. So I'm going to just redo that again, just to mention. But Mike, back to you. in order of, well, I'm just thinking here. I don't want to get into a big discussion on what you want to do, but right now, you know, taking up this time, because I don't have the time to do both tonight because there's something else that I got to take care of. So, Mike, you want to speak later about the different antennas, and I can tell you which one you should go with, and you can tell me the size, property, and I'll give you my best answer for what you want to do. How's that sound?
Yep, perfect, Andy. Thank you. Yeah, let's not hold this time so you can do your presentation. I mean, we can meet on the other repeater or this repeater anytime. Thank you so much, Andy.
All right, because, you know, the bottom line is you could just put up a random length piece of wire, and that's what it's called, you know, just a long wire. As an NFED antenna. But the best thing to do is you got to make it at least a half of wavelength, half wavelength long, then it would act more like a dipole antenna. If you want at least, I don't know what frequency you want to use it for, but whatever the lowest frequency that you want to use it for, so it has to be a half wavelength of that, which obviously will be longer in length because it's a lower frequency. So if you want to operate on HF, you know, if you want to make it on the, if you want to use it on the 75 meter band, then you just have to make it a half wave of length on the 75 meter band. So, and that would perform sort of, you know, more like a dipole type of antenna that's center fed rather than feeding it at the end. The only thing is that your impedance is different because you're feeding it at the end of the end of the wire. All right, so with that, let me give it back to you, Roy, and then when you're ready for me, I will continue my discussion on the UHF propagation. Back to you, Roy, WA2CDM.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Andy, and Mike. You got some reading to do, some Googling to do, and Andy will help you as well. And again, I'm always here. If you want to ask questions, the TextNet is made for that specific thing. So I wish you good luck, Mike. Yes, Wesley?
I was barely able to hear the problem that he was describing with the chuck, heater chuck. It's an old transceiver that is operational on the tubes. And if I could hear more about it, I have a schematic in front of me. I mean, the diagram schematic, maybe I would be able to help. The tubes is the simple stuff.
So, okay, I mean, Andy offered to help Wayne with it. He says that there's something that's designated as a heater choke. What happened was someone plugged in the wrong power supply to the unit and burnt out two transistors and a heater choke. And he was looking at the specifications, and he couldn't find the inductor rating for this heater choke.
My question is, can he take out to see how many winds is on it? Simply rewind it.
I do not know if he's prepared to rewind an inductor. I don't even know what the nature of the inductor is. You know, some inductors are rather simple and others are a large number of coils, so I don't know. Wayne, if you're out there and you want to answer that from Wesley, he's curious about that heater choke. Is it sealed up, or is it or can you visually see the coils of wire on it?
Yes, Roy. Can you hear me? I switched antennas. I'm on a HD right now. The heated choke is about 3/4 of an inch long, less than 1/4 of an inch in diameter. It's got very, very fine copper wire on it, almost like the width of a hair. I mean, that's how fine the wire is. I did not count the windings. It is broken or burnt because I checked it with the continuity gauge. So halfway through, there's a break somewhere. I did not count the windings, so no, I didn't.
Okay, yeah, I mean, unless it's a very, very low inductance coil, it's kind of difficult to do that, especially fine wires very closely wound. So, does that answer your question, Wesley?
Yeah, it's very simple thing. I did it, but it's 28-gauge wire. And all you got to do is just unwind it and take any random 28-gauge wire and just wind it. And you don't have to be worried about how nice do you wind it. So, instead of just looking for the replacement part, which you're not going to find it, you could do it by yourself. Of course, Andy could do it as well. There is no other way. I mean, you can try to find out the chuck that is similar on it, but you can have a simple way of measuring it if the winding is still okay. If the winding is not okay, that means the enamel on it is burned out, you're not going to be able to measure it, and Andy is not going to be able to help. That's my understanding. And Twix here.
Well, Wesley, I understand that if it's burnt out, you're not going to be able to actually test its inductance. And if it's heat damage, it might not be very amenable to removing whatever glue or material is keeping it all together and measuring out the length. But, you know, hopefully someplace there's documentation of approximately what that inductance is, and so it's not that difficult to get replacement inductors because, you know, it's basically just coils of wire. So I think it's doable. It's not something you'll be able to get at the corner drugstore, but I think if you know this model and can research it, you can probably come up with something that will do, if not identical, then real close to it.
On YouTube, there is a video, Kenwood TS-511S, and I believe that I've seen it. And my impression is that there is no glue on it. It could be conformed. Interesting.
Well, I, again, don't know. Haven't ever seen that model. I should believe that Andy has had experience with that model. So I would suggest we let Andy and Wayne discuss it over the next week. And if they need any further advice, they could always come back here next Sunday.
Yeah, it's his choice. Yes, Andy is definitely an excellent guy in it. And I was surprised many times with how deep Andy is able to understand things. He doesn't look like what he knows. joke. And take care.
Okay. Well, it's 8:45. It's a perfect time for Andy to leave his corner and come over and tell us about UHF and VHF propagation. And it's sort of appropriate for our lovely little VHF repeater here.
Okay, boy, very good. WHCDL, this is Andy's Corner, and good evening to everyone. And Wesley, thank you for the kind words. I appreciate that. It's, well, you know, like yourself, you know, it's being curious about things and trying to understand how things work. And, you know, as Dick used to say, it's always a challenge to try to figure this stuff out without going into all the math that's involved. Anyway, okay. So we'll discuss, you know, by the way, listening to the signals is a lot better than it was 2 weeks ago. We actually were up at the repeater site and we did some work to try to clear up some of the issues. So I'm listening to myself so I can tell it, you know, there's no that breakup that was occurring. There is some static, and that's that will be alleviated eventually. So in regard to UHF and VHF propagation, it's a very short paragraph. Actually, I'm looking out the window and it's snowing now, and it's starting to accumulate. So be prepared. I need to move my car in a not too distant future and put it into a spot where I won't get plowed in. So I got to do that. So just thought I'd mention that. Okay, so here we go. This is UHF and VHF propagation, and this has to do with the radio wave and, you know, the way it travels on these UHF and VHF frequencies. So, and I'm actually reading this from a book that it's non-mathematical, but there are some diagrams here that it shows. So you're going to have to maybe visualize some things that I'm going to say. So in the UHF and VHF ranges, the ground wave extends for such a short distance from the transmitter that it serves no useful purpose for broadcasting. At the same time, the sky wave is not bent enough by the ionosphere to return to Earth. So all high-angle radiation at these frequencies passes through the ionized layers, except for the weak, scattered reflections. With sufficient power and sensitive receiving antennas, these scatter components can provide reliable communications.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, that was perfect because I unkeyed. So you didn't miss anything. Let me just stand by. I gotta remember to unkey. So in this frequency range, the wave we are concerned with mainly is a direct wave. Signals at these frequencies travel very nearly in a straight line, much the same as a beam of light. If the signals were to travel okay, stand by 1 second. We just had a momentary power failure. Let me just make sure everything came back. Although my radio didn't go out, but the lights flickered. All right, if the signals were to travel in an absolutely straight line, the range over which the signals could be received would extend only as far as the horizon. The signal would then go out into space, as a diagram here that explained, that shows this, as shown by the dashed line beyond point A in figure. There's a figure here which shows you, you know, from your antenna going out, you know, so if you're going out into a straight line, just, you know, imagine a signal leaving your antenna and just keeping in a straight line until it keeps going straight until it hits the curvature of the Earth, because as you go further out, you know, the Earth curves. So you just visualize that. That's why these signals will only travel out to the horizon. So actually the range of transmission extends quite a way beyond this optical line of sight, because the atmosphere bends the wave and causes it to follow a more nearly the curvature of the Earth. So, you know, the atmosphere itself will cause it to bend. I'm just repeating that. This bending gives good reception at a certain point, considerably beyond the optical line of sight. So in other words, if you're just looking straight ahead, you know, how far can you see? You know, the radio wave will travel past that, but it'll because of the atmosphere, it'll cause it to bend, and it'll eventually, you know, the bending will come dip, make it come back down to Earth at a certain point further than what you actually see. So this bending gives good reception, as shown in my figure here, considerably beyond the optical line of sight. And this is also referred to as the signal line of sight. So signal line of sight is what you can actually see, which takes into consideration the refraction by the atmosphere. So I hope you, if you're listening out there, you're visualizing what I'm saying here. Thus you can see what I'm talking about. This bending takes place in the lower atmosphere near the Earth's surface. It is called tropospheric bending or tropospheric propagation to distinguish it from ionospheric propagation. So you have ionospheric and you have tropospheric. T-R-O-P-O is what this, how it's spelled. Tropospheric as opposed to ionospheric. Okay, now, here's a little blurb on this. A sometimes disputed but widely used rule for predicting VHF-UHF transmission range and coverage is based on a so-called four-thirds Earth's radius ratio. So I guess what they do is that, you know, they calculate the Earth's radius and they figure out is, you know, the actual range based on the curvature of the Earth. So that is, it's the radio line of sight transmission range would be the same as the optical line of sight that would cause, or it should say that would exist, where the Earth's radius increased by a factor of four-thirds. And they should actually show a visualization of that, an illustration of what four-thirds, you know, looks like. And this is a disputed, they say it's a disputed rule. So I guess there are engineers that believe in it and some don't believe in it. But it's mentioned here. All right, so in regard to the illustration, it shows the actual, what the line of sight is, what the optical line of sight is, what the signal line of sight is at the four-thirds radius location point. And again, you know, if you just you don't have to understand it, just I'm just reading what it says here of how they calculate the actual distance, you know, because of the curvature of the Earth. So the actual line of sight, however, it's not a fixed quantity, but varies with weather and atmospheric conditions. And we know that because, you know, we have band openings here on the VHF and UHF bands as what we call tropospheric tropo propagation. There are times that we can actually get into repeaters that are hundreds of miles away on this band, and especially in the summertime. And usually when a front comes through, when you have changes of atmospheric pressure and front and so on, we've experienced these phenomenons at that time. So it definitely occurs. So So, and it says it right here, the actual signal line of sight, however, is not a fixed quantity, but varies with weather and atmospheric conditions such as temperature, barometric pressure, and water vapor content in the air. The signal strength at a given receiving location depends on several factors such as distance between the transmitting antenna and the receiver, the transmitted power, the net signal strength of the group of signals arriving at a receiving point, and the amount of waves and the amount the wave is bent in the atmosphere. So you got a number of factors. You know, your power level and how much what the atmosphere is doing, and so on. More than one wave of the transmitted signal reaches the average receiving antenna, although the direct wave is usually the strongest. In the propagation of TV or FM signals, signal components may arrive at the receiving antenna after being reflected from the Earth or from some large object or being refracted from the upper atmosphere. Yeah, so at a certain point, you know, you have multiple waves receiving at the same time from your transmitted signal. You have your direct wave, you know, which mainly was mentioned in the beginning because of the line of sight. But then you have your Earth reflected wave also, and you have your tropospheric wave. See, you can actually have three separate waves being received at a certain distance from your transmitter because of this effect. And it's called multipath, which is a common phenomenon, common condition of when waves propagate through space and from point A to point B, you have what we call multipath. So an example of multipath propagation is shown in a little diagram here of what it looks like. So you could just visualize, you know, a transmitting antenna and then a couple of 100 miles away, a receiving antenna, and then you got the waves, you got the ground waves, or direct wave, you got the Earth reflected wave, and then you got the tropo wave, all arriving, you know, at the same point. Okay? A reflected wave component, whether it is reflected from the Earth or refracted from the atmosphere, travels a longer path than the direct wave. So that makes sense because it's not a straight line, it's being curved. These two signals may add to give a net strength greater than either one, or they may cancel and give a net strength less than either one. Therefore, it is possible that certain locations will have weaker signals than locations further away. When the path taken by reflected signal is much longer than the path of a direct wave, two identical signals will arrive at the receiver, one after the other. This will cause garbled sound or ghosts in a television picture. And maybe you guys witnessed that. You know, when you used to receive by a receiving antenna, and you tune to, channel 2 is in the VHF range. Channel 2 broadcasting is in the 56 meg range, or used to be. I think it still is. And then any channel above that is higher than that. And that's because a TV transmitted signal takes up 6 megacycles of bandwidth, which happens to be a fact. So you need a higher frequency to accommodate that bandwidth. And I've witnessed that. Sometimes you get, from your aerial that's mounted on your chimney, you see another station coming in, you see ghosts, you see flutter, and so on. So that's a result of what I'm describing here. And that'll usually occur in the summer, where when the atmosphere is warm and you get temperature inversions and so on, where we would receive this. And I remember seeing that quite a few times.